ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $14.99 per month, that's Downpour.com. On this episode, author Josie Dillon talks to us about her book, Under the Blue. We get into the dynamic delicateness of Jive Cooley's music, and You're Dead Anyway in this audiobook feature, right after the news you want to know.
Hello, I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Lucia Sherman.
And I'm Cyrus Emerson. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. In June 2003, as the movement to recall California Governor Gray Davis was gathering momentum, Arnold Schwarzenegger paid Karl Rove a visit in the West Wing of the George W. Bush White House. Schwarzenegger was intrigued by the idea of getting involved in a recall, but Rove was dismissive. "It will never happen," Rove told Schwarzenegger. "There will be no recall election. Plus, if there were to be one, I don't think anyone can unseat Gray Davis." As Schwarzenegger recounts the scene in his new memoir, Total Recall, Rove then led his guests down the stairs, where they bumped into Condoleezza Rice, Bush's national security advisor. Schwarzenegger suspected the encounter was planned because what Rove said was meant to knock the movie star off balance. Rove said, "I have someone here who is interested in running for governor." This brief encounter is among the more intriguing moments in Total Recall. 5 days before the 2003 recall election, the Los Angeles Times broke a story that said six women were claiming that Schwarzenegger had groped and humiliated them on movie sets and other locations over 3 decades. Leaving his past behavior largely unexplored, Schwarzenegger comes across as a slightly profane, likable enough fellow, the sort most guys would love to join for a beer or a cigar or for Pumping Some Iron, which was a great movie and really set off his career here in the United States. Pumping Iron, if you remember.
I do.
I don't remember the movie. I just remember when he was governor of California.
And, I want to pump you up.
Is that where that came from?
I think so.
Oh, you know, I do remember the parodies they did on Saturday Night Live. I did not know it came from that movie.
Well, I don't know about that movie, but just Arnold.
Right. Yeah, well, the movie was great. Schwarzenegger and then Lou Ferrigno, who, you know, played the Hulk, was another really popular bodybuilder at the time. They get into this mental match at the World Championship bodybuilding contest, and Schwarzenegger just mentally destroys him. And then goes on to win, you know, the contest.
I like Arnold a lot of his movies. Not all of them, because he's made so many of them, but like Twins, I love Twins. And I did love that movie, Total Recall. It was one of the first sci-fi movies I saw that I thought, like, wow, this is pretty good. Arnold, what a plethora of one-liners, you know. "I'll be back." Cyrus, you have to stop acting like a girly man.
Yeah, that was one of the his regrets as governor of California, was saying that to legislatures.
Right. Yeah, you know, when he was governor of California.
That's a good impression, Charlie.
Is it?
Yeah, Schwarzenegger's probably going to listen, and maybe he'll give you a call.
I'm not talking to Arnold any longer. Ever since he went out with my cleaning lady, Maria.
Oh, house. Ooh, yeah.
We weren't going to touch that. Cat's out of the box now.
Yeah, I'm just here to pump you up. Hey, you know what? That book sounds good, and it sounds really fascinating, and I really do look forward to reading Total Recall. And but I understand that Justin Timberlake has a new project going, and he, like Arnold, is going to be back, right?
Who am I to say I want you back when you were never mine to give away? Those are the opening lines of a song that accompanies a new MySpace promotional video. The once mighty social network is trying to stage yet another comeback with the help of Justin Timberlake, as you said, Charlie. The new site for which people can request an invitation looks a bit like an entertainment-focused version of Pinterest, with a dash of Twitter and Facebook thrown in. But MySpace has tried to redesign, as before, but to no avail. Will it work this time? Well, from the sound of it, MySpace wants to win the hearts and minds of tech-savvy hipsters. Founded in 2003 and initially a fast-rising star, MySpace attracted mostly teenagers and 20-somethings, offering them a place to express themselves online. I know you had a MySpace
and I still do.
Page. Oh, you do?
Yeah. Yeah, I just got friended the other day by a band called The Royal Concept, a Swedish band. So people are still on MySpace and, you know, mostly a lot of music.
Yeah. But the site has lost its footing as the fun of customizing profile pages began to bore its users and the site's heavy use of banner advertisements slowed the speed. At the same time, people were already migrating to Facebook, which counted users 35 and older among its fastest growing demographic.
Yeah, you know, that's funny about the Facebook with the demographics because everybody got onto Facebook, whereas MySpace was more a younger person's vehicle. And I've seen the new MySpace. It's really sharp looking. It's got, it's cool. Mainly the program is designed for artists.
Oh, after my own heart.
You know, Justin Timberlake is, he's got such star power and has so many, you know, big time friends that they're all going to see if they can't, you know, help it out.
Yeah. The company's new promotional video offers a 2-minute and 18-second peek into the slick, image-heavy site. The site's much cleaner look, which you said, Charlie, is a stark contrast to the old MySpace. Posted this week, the video promises that MySpace will start totally from scratch, as if trying to shed its former self. It doesn't say when the new site will launch, only that it's not ready quite yet. Timberlake, who's featured prominently in the video, will likely play a big part of the MySpace revamp. The former NSYNC pop star, with a group of other investors, bought MySpace last summer from News Corp for $35 million.
Wow, you know, that's amazing. You know, like we said before, Justin Timberlake bringing sexy back, you know, and of course we know Sarah Summerson is going to bring cornrows back. You know? I think you need to throw that up on your MySpace page there, which looks a lot like the new Facebook page with the timeline, the big picture on top. Yeah, except, you know, on Facebook, you would have like charts on the side with chat, people to chat and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
On MySpace, it would have players where you could play your music. So it's pretty cool.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it is. With it MySpace, sounds cool. You know, that was one of my frustrations with it, was that the speed was so slow. It was really hard to upload your page and go onto somebody else's page. It would take a couple of minutes because of all the banner ads. So it's good that they've addressed that issue, and it should make it a better site where you can navigate and go around. Another cool thing about MySpace that I enjoyed being a writer was you had a blog, and I got a lot of hits.
Unlike Facebook?
Facebook. So
because Facebook doesn't do the blog, and you know, and the reason they don't do the blog is because, unlike MySpace, they have almost 1 billion users. It's just too much tracking.
Right.
Yeah.
They both have advantages, and maybe MySpace can stage a comeback, especially with the latest turmoil with Facebook.
Tell us about it.
Well, all around the world, Facebook users are outraged that the social network has exposed to all their friends their private messages from years ago. Facebook profile pages are now formatted in timelines that stretch back to when a user first joined the network. These users say that their friends are able to scroll back to the early parts of these timelines and see what were once private messages. The fact is, however, this glitch does not exist. Facebook has debunked it several times to several media outlets. We believe Facebook. Facebook is a publicly owned company now, and a catastrophic glitch like this would be a material issue if it were real. So the company would face all sorts of lawsuits if it were lying. What seems to be going on here is that Facebook users going through their timelines can't believe that they, in the past, said certain things in public. They are having a digital hangover from their wanton youth.
Oh. Yeah, yeah.
Has this happened to you, Charlie? You're on Facebook a lot.
You know, I am on Facebook a lot, and you know, but ironically enough, and probably because you know of my ignorance to technology, I didn't post a lot of pictures 10 years ago because I didn't know how. But I could see where you were, you know, like if you were a teenager 10 years ago, or, you know, and you posted up a bunch of, you know, you went to the Grizzly party or whatever, and then you thought this was cool and that was cool, and this was lame and that was lame, and, you know, just typical ideas that you have when you're young.
Right.
Then you're like 28 or 30 and, you know, you have your career.
I can't believe I posted
that. And people were like, hey, dude, was that you, you know, with the Abe Lincoln hat? And,
you know, that's one reason why I never joined Facebook. I only joined.
Oh, you're the one.
I only joined once to find a former friend from years and years ago, but I'm not involved. You know, I don't want personal stuff out there.
You know what? I don't mind because, you know, at my juncture in life, I really don't care. And, you know, I could just have pictures.
And you're pretty boring anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I mean, but if you want to know everything there is to know about surfing and baseball, you should go to my Facebook page. And because that's what I'm into. But I mainly use it for business because you can't, you know, deny almost a billion users out there. It's ludicrous not to go on there. And that's how I got involved with Facebook.
Well, just Imagine It Inc., right?
I mean, yeah, Imagine It Inc. Facebook page is really, as they say in the industry, is really blown up. But but it's a good way. To put your message out there, and then, you know, people from all, as we know from doing our radio show and podcast, people from all around the world access it.
Well, in terms of personal information, but in terms of business, as used as a business site, I think it is very smart.
Yeah,
I
you know what? Blackstone Audio
that.
Actually did a book about Facebook. They published the book, they didn't write the book, but the book had a great title and it was fascinating. And when I first saw the book, you know, when it came up on the list of what, you know, what we wanted to publish, I was like, wow, this is like a murder mystery, right? But it wasn't. It was called I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, right? And it was the story of Facebook.
Wow.
When you think about it, because like Facebook, and they tell you, and it's so true, is that there's nothing on Facebook that you didn't put on there yourself.
Right.
It's true.
When if you have like a business website or something, you end up having to pay Google ads to drive traffic to it. But with Facebook, you know, your banner just pops up. Your name just pops up to your friends and to their friends. And you can just grow virally without even, you know, you don't have to invest.
Or Google. They've been trying to, you know, play the catch up game with Facebook. It's ironic because they had a chance to buy them and they turned them down. Eric Schmidt from Google said that was one of the reasons he stepped down as CEO because he talked with Mark Zuckerberg and he passed on him. He said, I don't think social networking is going to take off. Okay, yeah, you know what? Speaking of Facebook, you know, I love, you know, being on there and seeing what my friends are into and stuff like that because I'll often see things, you know, that remind me of what it was like when I was a teenager. And which leads me, you know, to this next story because, you know, like summer may be over, but legendary rock band, the Beach Boys, were excited to rock out to their 50th anniversary reunion until this happened. I can't believe, one, that it's a 50th anniversary, but I guess it is. But according to the publicist, the last leg of the tour in London was scheduled for this week, but it didn't stop Mike Love, who controls the rights to the band's name, from giving fellow band members Brian Wilson, Al Jardine, and Mike Wilson the axe. The post-anniversary configuration will not include Brian Wilson, Al Jardine, and David Marks. 50th reunion tour was designed to be a set tour with the beginning and the end to mark a 50-year milestone for the band, read a statement issued by Mike Love. The announcement comes 5 days after the band celebrated their five-decade career at the Grammy Museum opening in Los Angeles. I'm disappointed and I can't understand why he doesn't want to tour with Al, David, and me, Wilson said to CNN. We are out there having so much fun, and after all, we are the real Beach Boys. Love will continue touring as the Beach Boys with Bruce Johnson and a backup band. The band, known most for its laid-back Kokomo lyrics, has also become well-known for their sporadic spats. If all else fails, they can always use a sub-in from John Stamos, formerly of Full House, who's sat in on the drums for them quite a few times. But yeah, you know, that really kind of surprised me because Brian Wilson is the musical genius behind the Beach Boys.
Absolutely.
And he is the voice, you know.
Yeah, and for me, I always associated, you know, Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys. You know, he was a key figure in my perception of the band. So,
and he wrote all the songs,
yeah,
right?
For him to not be involved in the tour is just shocking.
You know, I did a little research on that, you know, as why Mike Love did that. And he's always been, like, kind of frustrated with the you know, being a clog in the wheel to the Wilson brothers. And he is one of their cousin. According to him, he's the youngest and far and away the healthiest. He just says that, you know, that the other guys were just complaining too much. They're tired. They don't want to go from one city to the next. And they're like, let's just cut this short. And they're 70 years old, you know? So I could see that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But still, you know, if I had a choice of what Beach Boy configuration group I wanted to see, I would choose the original one. I don't know if I would pay money to see just one of them and a backup.
Right. Band. I mean, yeah. I sent a letter to Mike Love and I offered, you know, to be in the band with him. It would be Mike Love and Charlie Love, you know, the Kokomo tour.
Charlie, what I said before, you are not boring. Speaking of Charlie Love, you know, you're a very multicolored figure.
Love the sports coat, too.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, I may not have been there for the Beach Boys when they began 50 years ago, but one young lady who was, the Mona Lisa, may have found a younger sister. Leonardo da Vinci painted a younger and happier Mona Lisa some 10 years before the famous painting, art experts are claiming.
She was probably in the basketball bikini league.
Out on the beach, yeah, in Avalon.
Was that the picture you painted? I didn't even know that Mona Lisa was in the
Louvre?
The Louvre?
Yeah. I've seen her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. I bet she was one of the Miami Spices or maybe one of the, you know, New York knockouts, but go ahead.
Well, you know, the one thing that I was surprised with when I saw her in the Louvre was that it was so small. It was tiny. I'm not tiny, but it was, I expected it to
much
be
larger,
a lot, a lot more grand. And
the one thing I
was
surprised about when I saw her in the Louvre was that she didn't even say anything to me.
I'm sorry, Charlie.
Yeah.
Well, this new painting is larger in size than the Mona Lisa that hangs in the Louvre.
Get out.
Yeah. And,
is that because she was younger and she hadn't shrunk yet?
It could be. You know, it also features a darker tonality and an unfinished background framed by two columns. Known as the Ellsworth Mona Lisa, the artwork will be unveiled in Geneva by the Mona Lisa Foundation, a Zurich-based consortium which has kept the painting in a Swiss bank vault for 40 years. A new book will provide historical, comparative, and scientific evidence to prove once and for all that the Ellsworth work is an authentic Da Vinci artwork, a spokesman of the Swiss Foundation said. Indeed, the painting's authenticity has been the subject of debate ever since the canvas was discovered in 1913 by English art collector Hugh Blaker. He bought it from a noble family and took it to his studio in Ellsworth, London, hence the name. Blaker then sold the painting to American collector Henry F. Pulitzer, who carried out more in-depth research on the painting, focusing on the columns which frame the Ellsworth lady. Similar columns are also shown in a drawing by Raphael of the Mona Lisa, now in the Louvre. The drawing was probably done from memory from Leonardo's original after Raphael visited the master in his studio in 1504. So this painting is definitely creating a buzz in the art world. It's not every day that a masterpiece is revealed to the public. I mean, what do you think about that, Lucia?
Well, I saw the pictures of the two, and it really looks like it's a true story because it looks like Leonardo in both. And, you know, I wasn't able to look at the strokes or anything, but it was just one that was more simple. But the second one, which I saw in the Louvre, had a more ethereal feel. And her smile was definitely more enigmatic. So it was beautiful.
It's one of those $50 words.
It is one of those.
I tried to say it.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to see a comparison between the two Mona Lisas. I'm sure I could go on YouTube and check it out.
Of course you can. Everything's on YouTube.
Isn't it though? The whole world's on YouTube these days, it seems like. But
yeah,
us.
It really is.
Well, we have a YouTube channel, right?
That's right, we do have a YouTube channel.
And there's a Jive Cooley interview on there as well.
There is a Jav Kooley interview on the YouTube channel, and you know, maybe if we're lucky enough, we'll get to you know, get picked up by mainstream TV, because it seems like it's happening all over the place, isn't it, Lucy?
Yes, it is. In October, U.S. TV network ABC will be broadcasting a cooking show that began as part of YouTube's Original Channels initiative, the first such deal to take a YouTube-funded program to national TV. That's very cool. For Google-owned YouTube, the deal is a milestone in its effort to rebrand itself as a place to watch high-quality video, able to compete with traditional TV for advertising dollars as well as audiences. The deal comes nearly a year after YouTube launched a $100 million campaign to shed its image as a repository for blurry, homemade cat videos.
I swear, you know, YouTube for the first 3-4 years, that's all you saw was like, look how adorable my cat is. Look how adorable my kid is.
My hamster on the piano.
I just posted a video from YouTube on my aunt's Facebook page of a fat cat jumping into a box.
I'm sure it's going to go viral.
Yeah. Well, I saw it on Good Morning America.
It was really funny. Was it funny?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Yeah, it's hilarious.
Actually, a lot of the animal postings are hysterical.
You know, some of them were, but it's like any other growing experience. I'm glad we kind of got, you know, are past that and over it, because it's like YouTube now, not only are they doing original programming, and the whole world's on there, you know, watching videos, but, you know, now they show movies too, just like Netflix and just like Amazon. So, you know, the Crackle. Way we watch our entertainment these days is changing so quickly. And the thing that YouTube, I think, is really cool about is they level the playing field. You don't have to be on to get your movie
National
out.
Network. Yeah, it's true. Well, actually, there is a professional program called Recipe Rehab. And that will make the jump to national television. Although episodes will be reshot with a 22-minute TV format, the show is being helmed by the same executive producer as the web version. And two of its star chefs from YouTube will migrate to the small screen. That's really good news for us. Recipe Rehab is the latest...
I feel like a migration coming on right now.
Recipe Rehab is the latest example of how creators are now harnessing the combined attributes of TV and the web to build scaled, engaged audiences. YouTube's global head of original programming said, Recipe Rehab, which teaches viewers familiar recipes, that sounds good, will be broadcast on Saturday mornings on 200 ABC affiliate stations across the United States. The show was a brainchild of Mark Koops, a veteran TV producer who created shows including The Biggest Loser on NBC and Fox's MasterChef, starring celebrity cook Gordon Ramsay. YouTube ultimately funded roughly 100 channels, including Everyday Health and many others that boosted tie-ins with actors like Ashton Kutcher, Amy Poehler, and former basketball star Shaquille O'Neal. I have one question. How come the guys in the NBA don't wear really skimpy little Speedos?
Well,
that's a good point.
But I'll tell you what, it was only a matter of time before human evolution brought us to this. Women in bikinis playing basketball in an organized league, Lucia. The Bikini Basketball League has been around in concept since 2011, but there haven't been any games as of yet. Even though there are 7 franchises that are set to open up in 6 different cities, there are going to be the Chicago Desire, Orlando Lady Cats, Miami Spice, Los Angeles Ice, New York Knockouts, Hollywood Hotties, and Atlanta Fleet Angels. You know, the Atlanta Fleet Angels, it doesn't sound right in there, but...
I know it doesn't.
But what are you going to do? You know, but considering the success of another one of our personal faves here at Get Behind Me Now, Stay There, the Lingerie Football League...
It's personal favorite?
It is, definitely.
It's your personal favorite.
It is.
Not mine.
Yeah, hey, it's no wonder that someone would start up a league with hot girls playing basketball. And, you know, I say, you know, hooray for that. I mean, hats off to that. I mean, often when I'm down there, as you know, I work out a lot. And, you know, and I have the, you know, the occasion to play basketball on the blacktop and stuff like that. There's always a lot of women out there that do play basketball, although I've yet to see them play in their bikinis.
But it's really kind of like beach volleyball. I mean, in the Olympics, they had the women in their little skimpy bikinis.
It's accepted.
It is accepted.
Garfield Park right here in Ashland, you can see women in bikinis playing beach volleyball. And then on the blacktop, you can play basketball, but there's never any girls over there. And bikinis playing.
That's because they're all probably trying out for the New York Knockouts.
Or the Hollywood Hotties.
That's right. What's next? You know, the Bikini Hockey League?
Yeah. No, it's the NBA players in Speedos.
The NBA players in Speedos.
Well, it also makes me think of one of my favorite places in Las Vegas to hang out is at the Caesar's Palace Casino at the Sportsbook. They have a big Pussycat Dolls slot machines and theme. Right next to the sports book. So, of course, you know, they're a famous group of women who like to wear
skimpy things.
Well, let me tell you this. There is going to be a Bikini Basketball Association. And either way you look at this, dudes and ladies, it's going to happen. And you've got just 36 days from this recording till it happens.
I'm starting
to work out, you know, to get ready for this. The Cape is coming out this weekend. I'm going to fly down to see the Miami Spice.
Are you really?
Yes, I am.
You know what? I wouldn't put it past you to do that.
Well, it's something that every man wants to do. I just want to be the referee. But you know what? If I was, there would be a foul on every play. That whistle would never stop blowing. And no, it wouldn't be a wolf whistle.
Well, you enjoy that vacation down in Miami, Sparky. But speaking of vacations, you should see the Griswolds now. Back in 1983, National Lampoon magazine launched its vacation film franchise. The film screenwriter was the man who would become the eminent 80s teenage angst writer-director John Hughes, who initially wrote Vacation for the magazine, not the big screen. Chevy Chase, now 68 years old. Can you believe that?
I know, it's kind of hard to believe.
Starred as a quintessential airheaded middle-class dad. The rest of the Griswold nuclear clan was comprised of Beverly D'Angelo, Dana Barron, and Anthony Michael Hall. I just remembered laughing and having a great, great experience the whole summer, Hall, now 44, told ABC's Good Morning America, who interviewed the group as they were at Entertainment Weekly for its annual Reunions magazine issue. Hall was just 14 years old when Vacation was made. The laughs have endured through the years, as the cast says they have remained in touch. We have this standing thing, explained D'Angelo, who, by the way, is now 60 years old and still looking gorgeous.
Isn't she ever?
I was amazed. She looks better now than she did 20 years ago.
That's true.
I thought so, too. Yeah.
She looks like she's 40. It's great. Anyway. It's the best family and rapport of actors I've ever seen, Barron, now 46, told EW. Barron was 16 years old when she portrayed the teenage girl. Then there's Chase's iconic scene when he dances seductively with the bologna sandwich in an awkward attempt to impress the mysterious and sexy Christie Brinkley. It just came about, Chase told ABC's GMA. She's dancing to some music that's coming out of her car, and I've got this sandwich, and I'm just watching her dance, and I start to dance a little like Clark would. And I've got this sandwich I'm eating anyway, so at some point I just decided to flash the baloney.
That's Chevy Chase. He is so funny.
He is. He was so funny in Saturday Night Live, too. I loved him.
One of those iconic lines they play every year on television when Hi, I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not.
Yeah. Didn't he do Gerald Ford, too?
Oh, yeah. He did a good one. And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Blackstone's special feature. As a teenager, Josie Dillon's imagination ran wild with the story she told her younger brother. Later in life as a mother, the story entered her thoughts, she wrote it down, and published it. The book is now available on Smashwords, Amazon, and iTunes in ebook format. She spoke about this process with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting episode of Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we are pleased as punch to have on
Josie Dillon, who is the author of the new book, Under the Blue. It is part of the Blue series. And welcome, Josie.
Thank you, Charlie. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on. Loved your book, by the way.
And, thank you.
You know, the first thing that that drew me into your book was the cover. The cover is, for all our listening audience out there, is a cover of, it's all blue, and it's a pier, and the title, Under the Blue, and I was like, well, you know, oh, I got to see what this is about.
Oh, really? You know, I actually had a hard time with that cover because, you know, my family, I grew up in Oceanside, and Oceanside Pier is my favorite place.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the inspirations for my story. I actually created a lot of the story sitting at the pier as a teenager, thinking about the story and having the plot in my head and, you know, figuring it out. And we were there last summer, my kids. I took my kids there for the first time, and they were running up and down the pier, and I was sitting there and took a picture of it. And at the time, last summer, I hadn't put my book out there. It was still in my computer. And I took that picture. And then in September, I stumbled upon Smashwords, which is where my book is right now.
Okay.
And I, you know, downloaded the book because it was easy to do. But then I didn't have a picture. And so I took that snapshot and played with the coloring and then threw it on there. And everyone seemed to like it, but I don't know. I was thinking it was maybe a little bit too blue.
No, it's
great. I've played with it quite a bit, but I do love Oceanside Pier. It's an amazing place. Have you ever been there?
You know what? As a matter of fact, I have.
You have?
I have. I've been there several times. I go down to Southern. We're in National Oregon, and I go down to Southern California usually once a month. Family lives there, so. I'm very familiar with it. I'm very familiar with Oceanside and Orange County and L.A.
Did you recognize that it was Oceanside Pier when you saw the picture?
No, I did not. But I wasn't really trying to figure out where the pier picture was taken from. But I was more interested, you know, in what the book was about. You know, and the book is it's different, man. It was a lot more. You know, to the book, then, you know, at first I saw the cover and Under the Blue, and I thought, wow, this is going to be a lot of fluff. And then, you know, I was like, wow, this is a really good story. Now, I don't want to give too much away, so why don't you tell our listening audience out there a little bit about your book and, you know, how you came to write it.
All right. Well, let me tell you how I came to write it. I kind of said a little bit about growing up there and going to the pier and having my inspiration there and thinking about the story, but you know, when I was a kid growing up in Oceanside, I didn't have any friends. I was kind of a social outcast. I was very nerdy, did well in school, but I just, for the life of me, could not find friends. I just was an outcast.
Oh,
I did have a stuttering problem.
Uh-huh.
I occasionally have it now, but when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I stuttered quite a bit. So, you know, I wrote the story. I wrote it in my head because I was alone quite a bit growing up. I had two brothers, one older, one younger. My younger brother, Chris, we're very close to this day, but back then, you know, he was incredibly popular, had lots of friends, but he and I were very close. So, you know, at night, I think it was about 14 when I first started thinking about the story. He was 11. And this one day he was watching me just kind of staring off. And he asked me, he's like, what are you thinking about? You're just kind of staring off all the time. And I told him, I said, this is the story that I've created, the story, and this is what it's about. And so he started asking me about it, and it almost became just a nightly ritual. He would come up to me and say, so what happened to David today, the character? And I would tell him. And this happened off and on almost nightly for 4 years until I left home. And it's kind of funny because a lot of things that happened in the story happened to me. And so, you know, they always tell you, write what you know.
Right.
So I was very much into the occult as a teenager.
Gosh, I never would have known that, Josie, when reading your book.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was very angry. I was very angry at God as a teenager.
Well, who isn't?
I did try to drown 3 times in one summer.
That'll happen. That'll happen at the beach. I've almost drowned at the beach several times, and many times it was unintentional.
Yeah. Well, I knew about the rip tides and the currents, and I just, I was a pretty troubled youth, although from the exterior, nobody would know.
Uh-huh.
I was a very preppy kid, very clean cut, you know, straight A's in school, honors courses. My parents were wonderful. I had a very good family, but just, I was tormented at school. I was bullied. And so this story was my way to escape. And my little brother, Chris, he kind of brought it out in me. Every night we'd talk about it. So it's a very long story, but, you know, the main characters are brothers. David is the older brother. Dylan is the younger brother. And I created them to be, you know, they're very close, but David is very dark. He's, you know, the typical rebellious teenager, smokes, curses, rebels against his parents, against authority. And then Dylan, who's the main character in the story, is very good-natured, angelic-like. You know, I mean, he's just a good kid.
Right.
And so they're both very close, and they grow up in this very conservative home where their father is a Christian pastor of his own church. And there's an older brother and two older sisters. So these are the two youngest children in the family that I write the story about. What happens is David, when I was a kid, I was fascinated by the dreams. I had very vivid dreams growing up. I still do. And so I had the older character, David. I had him go into a dream world. He would dream every night, and he would go through his bedroom closet and go into another world. Except in my story, he goes down into the underworld, which was my view of hell.
Right.
And he gets drawn into the world by the villain in my story. And he's the devil to anyone, but his name is Asmodeus, and he's drawn to David. He's drawn to his dark soul. And he's a collector of souls, just like we know the devil is. And so he wants to collect David's soul. So David's
drawn to him because he's from the dark side.
Right, he's very dark-natured, so he's got a dark soul. And Asmodeus is drawn to that. And so he invites him into his world at night when he dreams, and he tries to get him to kill himself. Because, you know, as we all know, if you believe in the Christian in Christianity, if you commit suicide, you go straight to hell.
I said, yeah, I've heard that my entire life. Of course, nobody knows if it's true or not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, who knows? That's why this is such great fiction, because, you know, you can pretty much go anywhere with it. Nobody knows. And my underworld, I was fascinated by Dungeons & Dragons growing up. I played Dungeons & Dragons with my brother, you know, so the whole, you know, elves and orcs and, you know, that whole gaming system was very popular in the 1980s where I grew up, and we played it. So, of course, that was another influence on me. But I've always been interested in the struggle between good and evil, always.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are fascinated by that, and, you know, rightfully so. But, you know, when writing this book, did you, you know, did it take you, you know, years to write? Or did you get some resolution out of it? Or, you know, because, you know, what you're describing what you're describing and what I got out of the book are like completely two different things. Which I think is great, you know. I mean, that's the beauty of a well-written book, is because you know, you have your interpretation of it. It's like almost like a songwriter when they write a song, and people interpret their song so many different ways, and they're like, "Well, whatever you get out of it is that's fine." You know, here's what I was thinking.
Right, that's true. That's very true. And I have to say, when I wrote this book in my head as a teenager, and then 20 years went by and I kind of forgot about it. It helped me get through my teenage years. And then once I grew up, I met my husband, we married. I was only 19 when I got married. We're still married today. It's going good.
Right.
But 20 years later, in my mid 30s, I started thinking about the story again. And some of the neighborhood kids were over at my house one day, and I'd mentioned it to my husband, and they were just like, "Wow, that's an interesting story. You should write it down." And so I did. I just like wrote one paragraph, and then the next day I sat down and wrote a few more paragraphs, and it took me about 6 months to write the first book. And then that was back in 2005. And then I wrote the second and third book the following years. It took about 6 months for each book to be written.
Well,
but, you know, I sent it to all these publishers, and it was, of course, turned down. And So I just kind of shelved it until last September. I think going to Oceanside last summer really helped me.
Kind of reinvigorated you?
Yeah, it did. It kind of made me think, all right, you know, I've got nothing to lose. I can put it out there, and it was great. You know, of course, e-books were coming around, and so they were all the rave, and I thought, I can just put it out there, and if people like it, great. And if they don't, then I don't lose anything. It's funny because when I wrote it, you know, I was just kind of ambivalent about God. And so, you know, I when I wrote it in my head, and then when I wrote it down on paper, I tried to stay true to the story, because I was only 14 when I originally created it. So I wanted to stay true to how I felt back then, which was hard because I was in my mid-30s, married, 2 kids, didn't hate God anymore. You know, I mean, I was happy with my life. I've been a nurse for 16 years. I've been helping people all this time. And, you know, I consider myself a good person, and I'm Christian focused. I mean, I believe in God. And so it was hard writing it, but I tried to stay true to the original story. You know, I've added a little bit to it to make it a little less angry, but I had to stay with the original story. I mean, I had to make David the main character. I had to make him angry, had to make him, you know, dark. I had to make him, your typical teenager. He curses, he smokes, he...
Definitely, everybody out there, read Josie Dillon's book, Under the Blue, and be sure to write a review on it. It's free, so, you know, write a review on Smashwords. You can let us know about it. You know, that is very important for, you know, all authors, whether they're first time, second time, or you're, you know, Ayn Rand. You know, everybody enjoys the feedback, whether, you know, because it's always, you always bring something
to... Even if it's negative, at least it's, you know, if they take the time to write about it, then that's flattering.
Well, you know,
even if they didn't like it.
Just like they said in Hollywood, there is no such thing as bad press. Well, you know what? It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we really look forward to having you on again and telling us about your next edition.
Yes, I will, Charlie. Thanks again for having me. Okay. I really appreciate it.
All right.
It was fun.
It was great, Josie.
To learn more about Josie Dillon, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
Jab Cooley blends the free spirit of snowboarders with the life of rock and roll stars, and they shared their story with us on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There in this great new interview.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. And today, we're very privileged to have on Jive Cooley, a band from Ashland, Oregon. Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. Good. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great.
Great to be on the show.
Yeah. Do you guys have a new CD out and... And it's called Sauce. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And, you know, you're going to be doing a Halloween show, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. You're doing here in Jackson County, you guys are going to do a Halloween show. We are, of course, around the world, but we also are broadcast here locally on KSKQ, which is 89.5 FM. Mm. And so for all the listeners out there, because a lot of people follow you on KSKQ, tell them about the Halloween show, man, and how they can participate.
Halloween show is going to be at Jackson Wellsprings. There's going to be Voodoo Banana, a nice other band here. Who else is playing? Lost Maven. So there's going to be three of us. It's a masquerade ball.
And, oh, wow, how fun. Yeah.
So what's kind of cool about that is it's, you know, a soaking spot. You know, it's like pretty much people are naked after dark. So it's going to be pretty much masks, people in the soaking tub listening to rock and roll, you know, on Halloween.
So it's a soaking party, and
yeah, I mean, it's at the Wellsprings, and we're
so damn, people are gonna be naked, so that kind of, you know, there goes your costume.
It right? could change the whole
yeah. It's gonna make things a lot easier on us, I think.
Yeah,
mask. Picking out the costume this year, okay, nothing.
Yeah.
Put something over my face so people don't know who I am.
Yeah, that would be something, huh?
But yeah, we're bringing the bus down there too, probably, and hopefully,
I saw a picture of your tour bus on your I think it's on your MySpace page.
Oh yeah, probably yeah.
Yeah.
Her name's cool Charlena. Yeah, she's great. She runs off veggie oil, Really? When we have it. So it also diesel, but yeah, that's how we got out here from Colorado, Eric and I, and that thing. So.
Hey, you know, it's so great to have you guys out here in the Pacific Northwest, but it's not where you hail from. So how did you get here?
Well, originally, me and Jordan both got sent off to boarding school in St. Louis, Missouri. And, you know, that's where we met. And we didn't play music together out there, but he ended up, somehow he got graduated from high school before I did. And ended up in Colorado, so I ended up out there too somehow. And started playing out there together. And after a few years of playing with our old drummer Tyler, we decided, okay, we got to go for the next phase. And just in that youthful, just adventurous spirit.
wait, hold on.
We need a little clarification here from Jordan.
Rewind. Yeah.
No, that was great. But I just want to think, I mean, I remember the first time when Eric and I played an open mic, and I was playing trombone
yeah.
And he was playing just acoustic guitar. Uh-huh. And it was really horrendous. It sounded like Dying Cats or something. And I think after that gig, pretty much Eric's like, you need to start playing bass. And we went out to Guitar Center or whatever and bought a crappy little bass. And so that was that. He was just like, you got to transfer your skills over to the
so
bass.
Acoustic guitar and trombone?
Trombone, open mic, yeah.
An open mic.
Anyways, okay, back to Tyler.
Okay, so we played a lot of shows with Tyler, and, you know, we met him at boarding school as well, too. Uh-huh. So the three of us were all fellow principiants, which is really funny. But, you know, after a while, he kind of got married and was focusing on that, and we were
how
like...
How do you kind of get married?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. But she wasn't really into the whole Jive Cooley thing very much because, you know, she wanted a little more from him, I think. So then me and Jordan were just we had this big plan. Like, we'll all jump on the bus. Whoever wants to go, we're going. We're going to live on the bus, you know?
Yeah. Right.
So we did. We got Veggie Oil. We got a school bus. We got a band. Let's go. Like, we're leaving.
Eric's sister played in our band for a little bit for that period.
Yeah.
We just played, like, wedding gigs. We had a couple random gigs booked until we ended up in Jackson Hole, where Allie got off the bus. And we ran into some musicians who were playing a show there. And they actually were on tour, and they needed a bass player and a guitar player. And
click.
Coincidentally.
Yeah.
So we jumped on that.
That's for all our listeners out there, that's Jackson Hole, Wyoming, correct?
That's right,
yeah.
Okay.
And the name of the group was Teton Songwriter Tour.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, three different songwriters that were going to come out to the West Coast. We were going to go through Idaho, Oregon, and California, back up, you know. So we got 3 months touring with them. I fell in love with a girl, and... Don't fall in love with the musician girls. They're bad news, man.
I'm gonna write that down.
Yeah, you should definitely make a note.
Make a mental note.
Okay, musician girls, no.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then, you know,
we made it.
Dancers all right then?
Dancers are great.
Yeah, that's classic. Yeah, musician dancers.
But we made it all the way down, you know, before we kind of moved out. We like kind of threw out some applications to work at ski resorts or whatever on the West Coast. And we got to the very end of the tour with these people.
Dive bomb.
We ran out of money and we're like, okay. We're screwed. We need to go back to Colorado.
Like in Santa Maria or something.
Santa Maria, that's what it was. It was like right at Atascadero, that whole area. The Last Stage West is the last gig we played with them. That literally is the name of the gig.
Last Stage West.
Yeah. And we got a call from Mount Ashland the day we decided to head back to Colorado.
We turned tail. We're like, oh, I guess we got to go back to Colorado. It didn't work out.
And he's like, you know, hey, yo, we got your applications. You guys interested in working at Mount Ashland? And he called me first. I was like, hell yeah. Well, we shared a phone. Next phone call, same person. Hey, is Jordan Mack?
Yeah,
it's me. He's driving the school bus. We're on the way. We're coming.
Yeah, I took a big U-turn.
Yeah, so we came up to Ashland. Never had been here before. And, you know, it was hard at first because, you know, new spot, not knowing anybody. But Mount Ashland, man, what a place to meet people and connect to the community like that. You know, everybody's so cool up there. And, you know, that's what drew us to this area. It was snowboarding, really.
Yeah. You know, so. And then there's the musician community here, I mean, it's just, the network is huge, so finding, you know, people to play was no problem. And then Braden had, you'd played in the Valley for a while.
Yeah, my story is not quite as exciting as theirs.
Not quite as dynamic?
Yeah, I basically came up from California, got priced out of the market down there, being that it was so expensive to live down there. So I'd been playing with a band for 10 years called Mom's a Hippie, which was like a pop rock
That's
band.
A great name, yeah. Mom's a Hippie.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's kind of cool, but it's hard to tell people that because they never, you know, they never really understand what's going on with the name. They're like, right. why'd you name your band that? Yeah. That's weird.
Was your mom a hippie?
That's literally, that's what the case was. The main guy in the band, his mom was a hippie.
So he called, we started off with mom's a hippie, you know, and as the band goes on, it's going to be grandma was a hippie.
You know? Yeah. Exactly. So anyways, I moved up here and dabbled around in the area. I played with a cover band, a local cover band in town, which was really, it was a fun experience, but didn't really enjoy covers too much. And then I got involved in a country band, of all things.
Wow. That's quite a switch.
But anyways, that didn't work out either. And I was searching around in Craigslist. And
what was the name of that band? Your Mom's a Hillbilly?
Yeah. yeah, something like that. Yeah. But anyways, I answered an ad in Craigslist and ran into one of the previous members of the band, and we ended up starting to play together and really hit it off. And so I'm not quite as crazy of a saga, but we all definitely ended up coming together in the end.
Now, are you feeling slighted because you never went to boarding school? Is that
I
what
didn't
it
go
is?
To boarding school, no. I wish I did. I probably would be more educated than I am now. But public school
failed me. A
little
more messed up.
Yeah. Listen, kids. Get out of public school. No. But yeah, anyways, we got together and we've been playing together for over 2 years, right? Approximately, maybe actually
about
close
three.
To three. Yeah,
almost three.
And it's been great. I mean, I love the music. It's, you know, Eric's a great songwriter, and so is Jordan.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, it's really really been fun.
Is there any song that just like stands out for the audience? Like every time you play it, people are like, "Oh yeah, yes."
It depends on the audience, because like last night we played with this band from Pasadena called Gypsy Hawk, and they're like kind of like 70s. I mean, I don't know if they'd say it, but this is what I heard. It was like revival rock. Like I told you earlier, like it sounded kind of like Kiss meets Metallica.
Right.
And just power rock, you know. And, you know, we were like, okay, we'll stick to our heaviest stuff. We played one funk song that was kind of the new one. That one didn't get any applause except for one girl. So it's like, you know, but if it were a different crowd, that might have been like the most popular one. So it all depends on who else we're playing with, what the crowd is, what the vibe is. But I think one that meets in the middle for everyone is a song called Feeding the Landlord.
Oh, I saw you guys do that song on a video.
Oh, cool. Nice.
Yeah, and it was like really cool.
Yeah, it's nice. It's just different because it's not straight 4/4. It's a little more interesting, but it's still like danceable, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it's a subject, too, everyone can relate to. And, you know, kind of the imagery there, you know, just thinking about... I don't know. The lyrics are great. They bring to mind a lot of things that we aren't really too happy about with landlords.
Yeah. So Feeding the Landlord, we saw you guys do it, you know, on the video, and apparently everybody, according to you, loves it when you guys play it. So let's have a listen to it right now.
Yeah.
Any other song you want us to feature?
Probably feature Smoked Trout. I mean, that's your
That's what I was thinking, too, is another... crowds really kind of get into this song. I don't know, because I don't really sing many tunes, and I think when I get up there, everyone's just kind of like, whoa, what's this guy support, doing up there?
What's the name of the song?
Smoked Trout.
Smoked Trout.
Yeah, okay. And it's about just hanging out with your friends and about just... having a lot of people over and kind of having a party and just jamming out with friends. So
then, Jordan, you wrote Smoked Trout, right?
Yes.
Oh, cool. Well, let's have a listen to that and see what the difference is between you and Eric.
Some great acoustic work in the beginning from Eric. And yeah, it's a fun tune.
Great.
Nice little transition.
Cool.
Any other tunes? Oh, I got to pick one?
Yes.
I think my favorite tune on the album that we have now is probably Wits End. It's an excellent song. Just really, really touches me. I mean, it's a great, every time I listen to it, I get emotional when I, you know, it's, you know, and we're holding hands right now, me and Eric, just
out there. Which end?
But yeah.
As I said, I think I feel a group hug coming on right now.
I mean, it's definitely not one of our higher energy tunes, but it's, yeah, it's definitely something I like to listen to. Sure had a hell of a time, but you look strong enough.
I want to thank you guys, each and every one of you, for coming out here and spending the time with us today. Sure. And we look forward to having you back on, man. And we'll definitely be at the Halloween show. Let's tell everybody where they can find you on MySpace, Facebook. I know you're on Facebook.
Yep, and Facebook, you're on MySpace, the Reverb Nation.
You got our website, www.jivecooley.com.
That's JiveCoulis.
Check out Jive Cooley's new CD. And pick up a copy. You can pick it up on their website. You can also go see them. They'll be a featured musical artist on justimagineinc.com. And we'll have all the links posted to your Facebook, to your MySpace, to your Reverb Nation. And once again, fellas, thanks so much. It was great having you.
Yeah, thank you, Shirley. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
To learn more about Jive Cooley, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
The city, I feel so impressed, so unpretty. The looks I receive, the vibes I retrieve, the lies I believe for the answers I need only help me get to the places I want to be. So dangerously, I want to be so dangerously
dead anyway. Imagine this: you have a nice life, you love your beautiful, successful wife. You're an easygoing guy working out of your comfortable Connecticut home. The world is an interesting, pleasant place. Then in seconds, it's all gone. You're still alive, but the world thinks you're dead. And now you have to decide. Make it official, or go after the evil that took it all away from you. Mystery writer Chris Knopf, who has examined complex what-ifs in 8 other novels, tackles these intriguing questions in a tale of mindless venality, phantom identity, impossible obstacles, and a triumph of intellect and imagination over brute force.
I felt reasonably secure at Jerry's studio and would have contentedly stayed there forever, but practicality drove me to move on before others at the clock factory registered my presence. I'd already picked out the next stop, a tiny, furnished, single-story house in Wilton, a town just northeast of Stamford, Connecticut, with a nice view of an abandoned, crushed stone and gravel distribution center, and thus one of Wilton's less desirable properties. I found the place over the internet, avoiding the owners and limiting personal exposure to a woman at a real estate office. She gave me the key after I showed her my driver's license, signed the lease, and paid 3 months' rent in advance, plus the security deposit. Invisible from the road and well removed from other houses, it featured the ultimate in privacy at a very affordable price. Still, I waited for nightfall to move in with my duffel bag and computer gear. The place had a kitchen with an eat-in area, a living room, 2 bedrooms, and a single bath with a metal-lined shower. A drop-leaf pine table in the kitchen opened into a decent workspace, so this became my base of operations. After setting up the gear, I made out a provisioning list, hardware, software, and consumables, before picking out a bedroom where I slept in my clothes on a bare mattress, registering the need for sheets and towels. The next day I went to the Wilton post office and secured a P.O. box, then I went back to the house and opened up an email account. I'd come to the decision that cruising a string of wireless hotspots, some intentionally unsecured, some not, was too time-consuming and inefficient. Sitting on a traceable IP address was an exposure, but couldn't be helped. I continued to harvest information on the New England underworld and outside influencers in New York and elsewhere. I copied the pertinent data into a 10-gig flash drive that screwed into a pen, and then deleted the file on my computer to the extent that was possible, shy of throwing the thing in a furnace. My last act for the day was checking email, where I found this in Mr. Peabody's box, from Eichenwright. Yes. I wrote back with a description of a bench in a park in Norwalk that looked out on Long Island Sound. I gave him 3 time and date options with the words, pick one. He came back almost immediately with his pick and a request for more information. I wrote, see you then.
Dead Anyway is a perfectly rendered murder mystery with enough unpredictable twists and turns to satisfy even the most hardened aficionado of the genre. Dry humor is scattered throughout. This offbeat story, told in the first person, is executed with faultless page-turner pacing and panache. New York Journal of Books. Fun book, says NPR. Chris Knopf, a sailor, cabinet maker, and advertising executive in Connecticut, lives with his wife Mary at their Southampton, Long Island home. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to blackstoneaudio.com.
Me Now Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Lucia Sherman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
And I'm Charlie Stanton. And remember, we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
Find yourself a girl.